What's up, everybody? Welcome back. Happy Skews Day to you. It's April 23rd, 2024. I'm Trey. That's Mark. How you doing, Mark?
Good, man. I'm still laughing about you regaling us in the pre-show about the guy who made a bunch of money being the first man to bring condoms to the Upper Cumberland area of Tennessee. So that's
a
man of the people.
He's dead now. I don't know if I should say his name, but he was like the biggest spot. He then went on to found like First Tennessee Bank and had a shitload of money, and he was a big sponsor. I got an MBA from Tech. That's how I know all this, because he was like the biggest sponsor or donor to the business school at Tech. But the way he was all ancient, even when I was in college 20 years ago, he was ancient. And his the way he made his first big chunk of money was he was the guy that brought condoms to the Upper Cumberland back in fucking the 30s or 40s or whatever it was. And he made no bones about it either. He was like, all in the market. What are you going to do?
Yeah, fuck the Baptist. we're talking about Tennessee tonight. We're talking about the United Auto Workers successfully unionizing a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga. We got John Russell, a reporter for More Perfect Union, coming on to talk to us in a little bit. In other worker news, Labor Department, we talked about the FTC and they're trying to ban non-competes. They successfully finalized the rule today. No non-competes for anybody who isn't basically a C-level executive, including current agreements being voided. Fuck yeah.
Good.
A lot of people can start their own companies, move jobs, upgrade their jobs. That's better for workers, better for the economy in general, which is not like, it's funny how much the economy working doesn't hit for like wealthy, powerful people. That's crazy.
Do you have any idea? Do you know that no one else is going to care about this? Will that affect like entertainers or anything? Because I often have the equivalent of I have non-compete sometimes, but the thing is, it behooves us all, including me, to not do that. Meaning, if I'm doing a show at this venue in a certain city, I can't book a show at a competing venue in the same city during whatever time frame or whatever. But again, that would be dumb of me to do that, so right. I wouldn't do that. But like, is this going to like keep them from? Is that or, you know, are we not going to be part of this whole thing?
I haven't seen how it works for contract workers, but yeah, right. We don't want to get too far in the weeds of that.
Typically,
but,
with the independent contractor thing, it's like,
it's a little different, yeah.
None of that shit replies to them. That's why people like to have independent contractors. Anyway,
right.
Go ahead.
Today, the Labor Department announced a new rule, proposed rule that would. So, you had a salary job, right? Were you? Mm-hmm. Did you ever get overtime?
Well, I worked for the Department of Energy, the federal government, and the way that that used to work for us was you got you didn't get paid more, but you got shit. What was it called?
Comp time.
Comp time, yeah. And you could. It got added to your like vacation days or whatever, and you could take that time off in the future, but you didn't get. And then at a certain point, you could cash that in for like when I left the government, all the comp time I had, they did have to pay me for that I did not use. So, kind of.
Well, I remember when I first graduated college and my first salary job, making $24,000 a year, I was told I was ineligible for overtime because I was a salaried employee and therefore management.
Right.
Yeah. I was management at $24,000 a year.
Right.
So we did get comp time, but comp time famously is just the amount of time you worked, not time and a half. I would have rather been paid overtime. True. Anyway, the Labor Department updated that rule. And now, so salaried workers will be eligible for overtime up to $59,000 a year. The current rule was $36,000. So ideally, it should be nobody, but raising to 59 is better than 36. And I was just thinking about,
what's stopping companies from just designating certain positions as being salaried or whatever, even if there's no need for it, just to avoid giving them overtime or whatever? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're still
nothing, that's what they've been doing for forever.
Right.
That's what
they're still able to do that, right? I mean, even that, it's just that the threshold is higher. So it's like,
right. They can do it for you, make it 59,000 or more, but not below that. Yeah. So, I was just thinking back to my days as an entry level employee at $24,000 a year, being classified management, you know, smoking my cigars in the lounges.
The only arithmetic they ever had to do was like salaried versus hourly was like, if you're hourly, we're not going to give you 40 hours a week. Do you know what I mean? Like if it was a job where they could not give you the hours to make a living wage, then it'd be hourly. If it was a job where they're going to work you to fucking death, they'd take any justification to, you know, make you a salaried employee so they didn't have to give you overtime.
Mm-hmm.
That's America, baby.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we're talking about unions today. So this made me laugh. So Ron DeSantis signed a bill this week, last week, I think, to require the teaching of history and communism, the evils of communism in Florida schools. And he had the bill signing ceremony and announcement on the Bay of Pigs anniversary on purpose, which I found fucking hilarious because Bay of Pigs is a farce.
Yeah.
We took a bunch of Cuban expats. We got them super drunk in, I think, Venezuela for a few months and did some fake trainings. They kept, a couple guys got caught selling drugs. They got kicked out. They kept sneaking off base to go to a brothel. So they had a CIA had to build them a brothel on the base. They wouldn't keep going off. Anyway, then we shipped them into Cuba on some rickety boats with no air cover. And they all got wiped out and caught or murdered or killed. And they were like, well, fuck. And now we're like, we get celebrating that as a great memorial.
I don't know. I mean, you tell me. I don't know. I never lived in Florida, but as I understand, this is kind of like a pandery move, right, to a big conservative voting block in Florida, which is Cubans. That Cubans, generally speaking, statistically, are conservative in Florida. And the reason, as I understand why, is because of they hate communism so much, which they associate with the left, because Fidel Castro and old Cuba and all that shit. And so, I don't know. Do they look at these guys as like the Alamo type thing? Do you know what I mean? Like doomed heroes or something? Is that like, do they celebrate this shit? I don't know. I'm asking.
Yeah. I mean, they were mad enough to, in theory, kill Kennedy over it. That's how the conspiracy theory goes. But because he didn't, you know, green light. But like, the whole thing is, I don't want to get into Florida, like the anti-communist politics, because like a lot of the first people that came over, of course, mad at Castro for, you know, taking their lands that they were running basically slave operations on. Yes. Yeah.
So, right. Well, yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. It's like, there's no context with just, oh, we were forced to flee because of how evil it was. But there's more to it than that, which is,
we're forced to flee because we were running sharecropping operations with the mafia and Fidel Castro put an end to it. Anyway, none of that's to say that all that stuff's fucking stupid and sucks, but it's funny to be the, like, have a class on Bay of Pigs, like they announce a class on Bay of Pigs Day. It's like, sure, communism's evil. At the same time, the anti-communists are fucking idiots who fucked up invasion of Cuba to a comical degree. Anyway, you want to talk real quick about the guy who set himself on fire outside Trump's trial?
Yeah, sure. Because I saw that, you know, I think probably like a lot of people, I assume, when I first heard a man has self-immolated outside of Donald Trump's trial, I just assumed he was like a Trumper who was doing this in protest of the witch hunt and the weaponized Department of Justice under Joe Biden that's unjustly coming after Donald Trump for nothing. That's what I assumed was happening, in which case I was like, oh no, you know. I don't want anyone to set themselves on fire. No. But you know what I mean. But then, yeah, but that's not. Turns out the guy who set himself on fire, he had a lot going on upstairs. Not the most mentally stable person. It's a little more complicated than that. He had a lot of ideas.
Yeah, mainly he was mad about The Simpsons. He thought The Simpsons was a conspiracy to, I don't know, like brainwash people into capitalism and make them open to Ponzi schemes that included Bitcoin or something. Let me read. For the guy's name was Max Azzarello. He said, he wrote, so I asked myself the question, if The Simpsons served the interest of organized crime, how would it do so? Well, that's an interesting question to ask yourself. I'm not sure you need to ask it, much less write a whole manifesto about it. But so his evidence, the evidence he points to is that The Simpsons represents, quote, a dysfunctional family suffering from moral decay, a community incapable of solving its problems, a worker drone who slaves away for an evil billionaire, and cathartic laughs for our poor collective circumstances. To which I got to say, that's the log line of the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's making fun of all that shit.
Of course.
But anyway, he thought it was like, I don't know, like all the conspiracy theorists seem to think the elites have to like signal their plans to us somehow. Right. And I don't know.
Crushing us under their boot and everything all the time. Yeah. Like, I feel like they make it pretty clear if you're paying attention. Do you think that like if, because we all know how mental health is treated in this country generally still to this day, there's not a lot of, support. It's like gotten better, but especially for men, it's a lot of just like, oh, if a man's got some wild shit going on, people just try to ignore it and he bottles it all up and nobody, like, I think somebody who's this far gone is probably not going to go try to get help probably. But like, do you think if culturally we were better about that, then things like this particular case would not have happened? You'd still have some lone wolf, wild motherfuckers every now and then, right? Even if we were better.
Right. He wrote in his manifesto about how isolated from his family he felt, but he couldn't get them to believe his Simpsons conspiracy theories, which is like, that's just kind of how that goes. But he also, the guy was like a Reddit celebrity. He was like a famous shit poster on Reddit. And like people like, wait,
what was his username? You know, I'm on Reddit.
I know. I don't know. I don't get on Reddit.
I'm going to look this up. I might have liked some of his work. I don't know.
So it appears to be just like an irony shit poster. Got so lost in the irony, he forgot where it started and where it ended and he started. But like he read a podcast that went 53 episodes that was totally devoted to Laura Dern.
Yeah, she is very talented. Very talented. I'm a
big fan of Laura Dern, but 53 episodes.
Yeah, like, well, Mark, hey, listen. Hey, if somebody starts a 53 episode podcast about the works of Quentin Tarantino or Martin Scorsese, you don't bat an eye. But celebrated thespian Laura Dern, she doesn't deserve that kind of coverage, that type of adulation. I challenge you, Mark.
By episode 53, you're down to like Dr. T and the women. You're like, well, I guess it's time to set myself on fire. Anyway, so. I want to talk about this Biden versus New Guinea thing real quick, because do you have any idea what the hell I'm talking about, Trey?
Not until it got into our show rundown, no. So Biden, he's pissed New Guinea off now?
Yeah, I mean, so let me read this headline to you, and we'll figure out how we got here, okay? So Papua New Guinea, this is from Reuters. Papua New Guinea leader responds to Biden comments saying, nation undeserving of cannibalism label. All right. So Joe Biden was speaking at an event in Pennsylvania last week, and he said that his uncle, Ambrose J. Finnegan, who was in the Army Air Corps he was a pilot in the Army Air Corps during World War II, was shot down in New Guinea. He was talking about his family's legacy of public service or whatever, and he said that, quote, they never found the body because there were a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea, he said. Okay, before we get to what actually happened here, do you remember Corn Pop?
The cereal? Who's Corn Pop?
A couple years ago, during the 2020 election, Biden gave a speech. We talked about how when he was growing up in Delaware, he was lifeguard at a public pool, and like he was talking about he volunteered to be a lifeguard at a segregated pool. He was trying to talk about like civil rights stuff or whatever. Anyway,
okay.
This guy named Corn Pop, who he said was a bad dude, pulled a knife on him one day. Yada yada yada. It sounded totally made up, but then people went and interviewed people from Wilmington in that era, and like, yep, we know Corn Pop, and he was a bad dude. All right, so. The thesis I want to hold you in your head for a second is the crazier a Biden story sounds, the more reasonable it might be to expect that it's
right. Yeah.
So the Defense POW MIA accounting agency has this story on record, and Biden's telling of it, except for the cannibalism part, which we'll come back to in a second, seems completely consistent with what could have happened. So his uncle Ambrose, who he calls Bozy, was shot down, or the plane went down around Papua New Guinea. One guy survived, was found, and said, yep, the other guys are in the plane. Go get their bodies. They went to get their bodies, and their bodies were gone. All right? So Biden's family appears to have come up with a story. Well, obviously, they were eaten by cannibals, and Joe Biden has just believed it for the last 80 years.
Yeah.
All right? But there's no reason. Here's the thing. There were a lot of cannibals in Papua New Guinea, or at least some in that era. And you cannot prove to me, Trey, that Bozy, Ambrose, was not eaten by cannibals.
Well, right? Another thing. I mean, like you already said, I'm just assuming what happened was his grandpa or whatever, Brozy's brother, Brozy's bro, probably told a young Joe Biden like that story. That's the family story. Like, right. Yeah, you know, that a lot of, and it's like that type of shit happens, man. Like there's so many different like families of veterans in it who have stories about somebody who dove on a grenade or something like that. And it's like, not mm-hmm. that has happened before. But you know what I mean? In any given scenario, how likely is it to be actually true? That's kind of how it goes with war stories. My assumption is just this is what Joe Biden was always told. Right. And he just rolled with it, you know? You said, you can't prove it ain't true.
Yeah. it's cooler than crabs ate him or whatever, right?
Right.
So I understand why New Guinea doesn't want like people talking about this and whatever, but I just want to point out that like Asia Pacific was a horrific theater of war.
Yeah.
And around New Guinea, there is still plenty of human remains, plane wrecks, shipwrecks, tunnels, and bombs that are unexploded. People are still like dying of unexploded ordnance. So what I'm saying is, it's not like only one group of people are uncivilized here. We're both talking about cannibalism. And I got to say, as a trade for all that, getting to eat Joe Biden's uncle seems like a fair swap. It led a minimum. So, yeah, whatever. Who cares? Anyway, that was funny. Trey's frozen. Okay. This happens since Trey moved to his new place, usually once an episode for a minute, minute and a half. He'll be back in a second. I'm assuming he's frozen and not me. Matt, if it's me, tell me. Trey's frozen. Okay, thanks, Matt. All right, so Matt, we're going to get to our Daily Dumbass. Hope Trey rejoins us soon. Daily, play that graphic, please, Matt.
All right. You hear? Have you just been sitting there this whole time, Mark?
No, you were frozen, not me.
I know I was frozen, but I'm saying, yeah, like when I froze, were you like, shit, here we go. Okay.
No, I vamped and then I played.
You vamped. Good. Yeah that was the plan. Vamp. Listen, we guys, I say this every week now, but
I told him while you're gone. Okay. All right.
Next week, I won't be here anymore. I'll be at the new place, and fake Lord willing, that will not happen. Anyway, all right.
Just do the day of dumbass.
Okay, very quick before I do that, go to treycrowder.com and check out my upcoming tour dates, please. I had a great time this past weekend. Me and Corey's book is on there around here and over yonder. And lastly, if you like this program, you can show us your support by signing up on Patreon, weeklyskews.com/more, or you can go on Patreon and look for my name. Either way, $5 a month, full-length bonus episodes. We do 2 a month. It's very fun. And you can, get some more skews in your life and support the show in the process. Now, we're getting into the main, like Mark said earlier, we got John Russell of More Perfect Union with us, talking about the biggest labor victory in the American South in a very, very long time, maybe ever. We'll talk about it. But before we get to that, we're going to begin with the Daily Dumbass. Matt, graphic.
I already did the graphic, Dre. I told you that a bit ago.
Sorry. I didn't hear that. I had to do my thing. Jesus. Right. Okay, God damn it. Did you do the lead-ins?
I did not do the plugs. Right.
Read
the Daily Dumbass.
Okay, all right. Okay, listen. So just so y'all know, our guest is in the green room watching this meltdown. So that hopefully makes it funnier for y'all. Anyway, tonight's DD is the GOP at large for not being able to fit reelect us, the real scumbags, on a bumper sticker. This is GOP Congressman Tony Gonzalez.
He will survive. Look, the House is a rough and rowdy place, but Mike Johnson is going to be just fine. I served 20 years in the military. It's my absolute honor to be in Congress, but I serve with some real scumbags. Look, Matt Gaetz, he paid minors to have sex with him at drug parties. Bob Good endorsed my opponent, a known neo-Nazi. These people used to walk around with white hoods at night. Now they're walking around with white hoods in the daytime.
I mean, bro, shit. Show me the lie,
Switch parties, motherfucker?
I know, right. Well, I don't know much about this guy, but if his whole thing is like, no, I represent what Republicans are supposed to be, then like, I'm glad there's at least some of him left that still exist. I've lamented the loss of any kind of reasonable Republican. They've been one by one forced out of the whole party. If there's any of them still out there, I'm glad it's not exclusively the lunatics just yet.
And the reason he gets primary, he replaced Will Hurd in a Texas district that spans the border. So like, I'm not sure why Texas border politics are more sane than the rest of the state, but he is known as a Republican moderate. That's why he's getting primaried by neo-Nazis. And he is for like marriage equality and stuff. So he's not nearly the worst. So this fight over whether to expel Mike Johnson is about the foreign military support bill with money for the overall majority, which goes for Ukraine, a chunk of it for Israel and slightly less for Taiwan. We could debate the merits of those bills in a later on or at a different date. But the funny part of this, if you want to looking for the comedy in it, is the Senate passed a bill that had tied Ukraine aid to border security. The House Freedom Caucus, the MAGA lunatics, support border security but oppose Ukraine aid. They blocked it. So then the House passed a bill that includes Ukraine aid but no border security.
Right.
That's what they got.
Not really following that.
Right.
Yeah.
So say what you will about the American left, the left wing of the American party. If it was passed a bill like Obamacare, that's like a half measure when it comes to giving people health care, they would complain about it not going far enough. They would not block its fucking passage and make pass something like worse, like a money for a war without that attached.
Right.
So,
yeah, no, they can't. They cannot govern. They can't get anything actually done. We talk about Tennessee in a minute, but another thing that just happened in Tennessee is the school voucher program, which was Bill Lee's big flagship program he was championing. It failed, and I'm so glad it did. But it's like, really, there's no reason that should have happened when you consider the stranglehold they have on Tennessee politics. You know what I mean? It should have been smooth sailing, but it wasn't, because these people, they can't. They're not competent. They cannot work even with each other to get anything done, even things they all want done or whatever.
They couldn't keep their mouths shut in Tennessee about the real agenda. But the real problem for them was like Republicans that represent rural districts realized right. they would have destroyed their schools. So they stood up for their constituents, which is how this fucking shit is supposed to work.
Right. Yeah, right? Exactly. No, I know. I mean, I'm glad that never happens in Tennessee. Right. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. they always fuck over their own constituents and normally it's fine, but this time they actually didn't because that's just how far they took it. Anyway, I didn't mean to divert us that much. Go ahead. Right. What were you saying?
So Marjorie Taylor Greene so far has chickened out from filing a motion to vacate with Speaker Johnson. She's insisting that he resign, which is like, I don't feel like doing anything, but can you just go away? Which is deeply funny. And we'll skip this next video, Matt. But like so they passed Ukraine aid after dithering for like 7, 8 months, 9 months, like while, you know, a bunch of Ukrainians were dying and Russia was taking more territory and getting more confident and Putin was getting more powerful. And then so... The only part of this I'm super for is Ukraine aid because I don't like people being fucking colonized by an imperial power. But like, so this headline on CNN fucking drove me crazy. By passing Ukraine aid, the accidental speaker became an unlikely Churchill. All right.
Come on, man.
If what? You mean like Winston Churchill, he's going to get a bunch of people in the Middle East killed.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
But if you meant he stood courageously, by the way, the only part of fascism that didn't hit for Churchill was the conquering England part. He liked the rest of it.
Of course. Yeah. But still, right. There's no reason to treat this guy this way. Mm-hmm. If you're CNN, you know what I mean? Why do this type of thing, man? But they do it all the time.
So as much as I complain about Democrats, I want to do this real quick. So today and the two parties are not the same. A lot of Republican reps try to attach riders to this bill, removing humanitarian funding. Marjorie Taylor Greene tried to add an amendment to build the Iron Dome, which is like Israel's missile defense system on the southern border.
Mexican missiles coming through, Mark. Somebody needs to do something. All right.
Right.
Tired of sitting back and let us, our Texas cities get bombed by the Mexican missiles every day. Anyway.
And because we do governing by trolling now, she also tried to attach space laser funding for the southern border. She also attached an amendment that said no funding for Ukraine until language restrictions are lifted on Hungarians in Transcarpathia in Ukraine. Now, Hungarians in Transcarpathia.
Yeah.
It's not worth getting into. It's one of those things that only, like those turns of phrases only used by like hardcore Russian nationalists like Vladimir Putin. So a bunch of people like got crazy on the internet. Like, obviously, she's in Russia's pocket. That'd be too big of a tell for an actual like intelligence asset. These people are just too online. Like if you don't pay attention to like the bow tie fascists with like classical statues and like their Twitter and Reddit profiles, they just are into this kind of shit. It just means she read a Reddit post she'd understand and copied and pasted into a congressional bill. So anyway, this is all fucking stupid.
Yeah, dude, that is right. You're right. It's like we have people serving in Congress now who see some wild shit on the deepest, darkest parts of the internet that just some other random internet denizen wrote. And then they go try to codify that into American law and stuff. Yeah. And that's the reality we're living in. So yeah, pretty wild. All right, let's get into it. So listen, guys, in case you didn't know, on Friday, the National Labor Relations Board announced that workers at a Volkswagen auto plant in Chattanooga, in my home state of Tennessee, voted to join the United Auto Workers Union. The union won by 73% majority, more than 2,600 votes, a historic feat. This was their third attempt to organize at this plant. It had failed previously in 2014 and 2019. This is the first time a foreign-owned factory in the American South, a region which, of course, has some of the lowest unionization rates in the country, has successfully unionized. And we're about to talk about it tonight, our guest, our returning guest, friend of the show, John Russell, a reporter for More Perfect Union. More Perfect Union is a nonprofit education, advocacy, and journalism organization with a mission to build power for the working class. Hell yeah, brother. Welcome back to the show, John Russell. Bring him out here, Matt.
Hell yeah, brothers. Man, can't believe I missed this conversation about cannibalism. That's when I told you. That was pretty crazy. What's going on, guys?
We're talking about eating the rich, buddy. It's on topic.
It's got me in.
did you want to show this video of you interviewing Sean Fain to get this conversation started there, John? Here's John interviewing UAW President Sean Fain after this historic win.
So thank you, first of all, for sitting down with us. Volkswagen workers just won their union. This is obviously a really significant moment, but help us understand how significant this moment is and how you feel about it.
Well, I mean, it's another mountain moved. You know, we in our Big Three campaign, you know, we were laughed at for some of our demands we asked for, and we were told you'll never get this, you'll never get, you can't bargain for retirees, you'll never get cost of living back, you'll never get the battery EV work under our agreements. And it's the same thing since then. Once we won all those fights in the Big Three contract campaign, when we talked about focusing our moving our focus to organizing in the South, all I kept hearing was, you can't win in the South. You know, it's not been done. It's not possible. And here we are. We've done it. And, you know, it's because, you know what it means. It's the first domino to fall. This was won by the workers here.
So, all right, John, like you said, you know, they said it couldn't be done. And like I'd mentioned, they tried before. So I'm from Tennessee. I got friends. I have one very good friend in particular who worked at this plant for years. He doesn't anymore, but he was there for a long time. And so I know that this has been an ongoing thing there. It had come up before and it had failed miserably in the past. I also know through talking to him that some of the tactics that were engaged in to like demonize unions in general and the UAW were pretty wild. But so, I mean, what happened? Why was it so different this time? Why did it get through with 73%? Like, what changed?
I'm glad you mentioned that at the end, because this, not only did this pass, not only did workers win a union, the first one in the South after 40 years, this was by a huge margin, 75%, right? So a lot of it was, you know, you mentioned the past attempts that came close but came up short. The anti-union campaigns were all things that people had heard before. It was a real boy who cried wolf thing. And I think the important thing to know about that is that kind of copy and paste over into politics. I mean, the anti-union talking points are some of the same stuff that, you know, Republicans will trot out all the time. You know, oh, they're going to close the plant. They're going to ship the jobs to Mexico. You know, this is somehow workers having a voice in their job is somehow bad for them. You know, this is all stuff that gets trotted out anytime working people get close to having more control over their lives. And people had just heard it all before. And what happened after they trotted those talking points out and they kept the union out in the other times, all those people who came in and said everything was going to go to hell, it all went away and people were left holding the bag just like they were before they started. So this time around, they'd heard it all before and they were ready. They were feeling squeezed. Everybody went through COVID and they found out how essential workers right. really were. And they said, you know what? We got nothing to lose, man. We got everything to gain. There's new leadership in this union. It's time for us to seize our slice of the pie. They did it. And it's a huge deal.
Well, do you think that there's also an element of like the cost of living continues to outpace wages and things like that? Like nobody's dollar goes as far as it used to. And that's only gotten worse year over year. And so the idea that, you know, when this happened before, it's like, well, it's still a good job or whatever. They worked me to death, but you know, whatever. But now it became more readily apparent to people just how screwed they're getting. And like, is that a larger trend too? Cause I feel like we're seeing a moment for labor in this country, not just in Tennessee or not just in the South. Is it cause people have just, they've just had enough. They've just been pushed too far by this whole thing.
I think so. I think you really can't underestimate how big the iceberg is below the tip that we're seeing. And I can't believe that that just came out of my mouth and I completed the metaphor I was thinking of there. But we are in, I mean, this is late stage capitalism, right? I mean, we have been handing power to corporations for everywhere. And now we're looking around and everything in our life is expensive and all of our jobs suck. And, you know, every time there's sacrifice to be made, it's coming from us, right? And it's the same thing at Volkswagen. I was talking to members there. You know, we all think of auto jobs as being this ticket to the middle class. I've covered a lot of these strikes. I've been up in Detroit when the UAW was first doing the Big Three strike over the summer, where they won a ton of stuff, which, by the way, the workers down in Volkswagen in Tennessee were looking at the Big Three. They saw those wins and they said, hey, we can do it here. If they can get that, we can get it here. That was a big factor of what changed. But you know, these, we all think of these auto jobs as a ticket to the middle class. I talk to people who are working this job and also door dashing. You know, I talked to auto workers in Detroit who said you can make $18 at Subway. Mm-hmm. I mean, these jobs aren't what they used to be. And it's because corporations, no matter what sector they're in, have all the power and they'll pay you the lowest wage they can get away with. And this labor movement is really just everybody around us, the people listening. I mean, you got to realize this isn't just for auto workers. It's for Starbucks workers. It's for wherever you work. People are realizing that if we join together, we can actually have a say in our workplace and start to turn this around. That's what happened down there.
Yeah, no, there was like a lone medieval times that was striking for a long time. They lost, and that was sad, but it was sort of nice to see them be plucky. But that one Waffle House went on strike a while back, and I was like, hell yeah, fucking. I love a little moxie. So I wanted to ask, so there's a lot of different stuff going on in the economy, and whether or not you'd like it, wealth inequality is awful. It's either shrinking or growing less quickly, depending on which data you look at. And Biden's running around bragging about his new tax plan, which raised taxes on the wealthy. But the reality is it's not going to be able to pass it because without a filibuster majority in the Senate, which he's not going to get this election. Is this the fuck it, we'll do it ourselves moment for the working class? Because it's like, right?
It is, man. You're damn right. It is. Look, I'm a lucky person. I get to go around and do a journalism job, right? And, you know, I think other journalists would look at me saying that I'm a journalist and probably say, we don't associate with him. But the thing is, you know, I get to go to all these places and talk to folks. And there's a real sense, we've all been looking to the political arena, political arena, somebody to vote for, to solve these problems that just keep getting more in your face and more unsolvable at the same time that our politics gets crazier. So the thing that I think is so powerful about the labor movement is people taking it into their own hands. You know, we don't think about, everybody values freedom, but we all walk into a workplace and surrender our freedom for, you know, hourly wages or salaries, right? And it's just that. It's like, hey, I'm going to pay you $15 or $20 an hour to be your king. Does that sound like a good idea to you? You know? And a lot of people are looking around and saying, hey, why don't we have a say in this? And so, you know, I think that's a long way of saying where the political arena is failing, the new labor movement is putting power into the hands of people and they're really feeling it. And that is something that's very contagious. And we're watching incredible wins happen. We didn't think the big three wins could happen. They got laughed at when they asked for a lot of stuff. Then they won it. Then they didn't stop there. Nobody would have blamed them for playing it safe. But they said, we're going to go into the South and organize a plant. People haven't seen that happen. They got laughed at again. And yet, and here we are. And the next one's Mercedes. So they're on a roll.
Yeah, I want to ask you about Mercedes in a little bit, but how did Volkswagen, how the workers feel like Volkswagen was approaching this? Because the context here, the Chamber of Commerce blamed the VW, Volkswagen, for not actively trying to defeat the union hard enough. The company decided to remain neutral in the campaign, which really pissed off the Chamber of Commerce. But for context here, Volkswagen's never had a problem with having a union, even in Tennessee. Because they're unionized all over the fucking world. And like, let me quote here. They wanted to unionize the plant based around a German-style works council. And Volkswagen considers its corporate culture of works councils a competitive advantage. So it's just funny to me that Germans were like, you guys in Tennessee are being too tough on the downtrodden. That just made me laugh. I mean, they invented work will set you free, for Christ's sakes. So like, why was the Tennessee government and the Chamber of Commerce trying to sabotage a company who thought this was the best way for them to operate? What the fuck?
Because of dickheads, man. You know, you had six Southern governors come out there and say that workers having a say over their workplace would go against the very way of life of the South. That's the statement that they put out, right? And it was just rejected by people in the South, and good on them for it, right? You did mention, though, it was pretty funny. Volkswagen is a company that has this principle of co-determination. That's where managers and labor are on, and labor representatives are on equal footing over company decisions. So that was another thing that changed when we were down there covering the run-up to this vote. And we, you know, we don't realize this being in America, that's not in our culture. Co-determination mm-hmm. of corporations, not something we consider. But you had German people down there. Oh, what was the line? The German representative of the Works Council was sitting in a group, a round table of all these good old boy Southerners, right? This is last week when I was covering it. And they said, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not very good at English. And then one of the good old boys chimes up and says, we ain't either. So you had a lot of people coming in to work for this win. You had the Germans from the Works Council coming over and explaining co-determination to people here. You had Ford workers from Detroit coming in and saying, hey, we won this at the Big Three. You can do this down here. And then you're seeing that worker-to-worker communication. Detroit Ford workers talking to Volkswagen Tennessee workers. Volkswagen Tennessee workers talking to Mercedes Alabama workers. This is a real movement that's gaining steam.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the tactics, sort of in line with that, but the tactics that have been successful in the past. You said earlier, it's this time around, oh, it's old hat. They've heard it all before. They don't buy the shit anymore, which is great. I appreciate that. But, like, you know, I think about, like, you know, coal miners, Johnny Paycheck, take this job and shove it, this whole thing. There's a whole thing of, like, you know, fuck you, boss man type of mentality in the South generally, yet unions have never been able to get a foothold there. Like, what has been effective? And again, I've known guys in this scenario. Is it just that, like, they pretty much get told, hey, would you rather have a union job or no job at all? Because if y'all do this, you ain't going to have no job. Nobody's going to have a job and you're all going to be fucked. And that's why you can't do it. Like, is that kind of how they get sold on not unionizing? Or, like, what kind of tactics do they employ to scare these people into, you know, not voting for unions in places like these?
Yeah, well, they'll trot out, you know, tried and true talking points. They'll say, oh, well, they'll move the plant to Mexico. Right. Why didn't they build the plant in Mexico to begin with? It's not like the wages are lower there and higher, you know, here to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. So you just, it's just these things that you, first time you hear them, you're like, oh, they might do that.
Right.
Well, the third time you hear them and it doesn't happen, you start to wonder, you know, especially if things get worse in the meantime. Something we haven't talked about yet, though, that I think did contribute to the win. There was turnover at this plant. You know, 10 years ago, the makeup, the racial makeup of it changed. 10 years ago, it was a lot more white and male. And I know from, you know, other reporters who have covered this before that, you know, past attempts to appeal to, you know, masculinity, right? They worked. They said, hey, you don't need somebody stepping in and speaking for you. You speak for yourself, right? Good luck fighting the company on your own, okay? So, you know, that's something that's been trotted out in the past, but, like, you know, as profit margins get narrower and narrower and more power trickles to these companies, you know, they keep squeezing the workers and they stay there for less time. So there were more people now who had been there a year, 2 years, 3 years, just enough people left over who had been there 12 years. Those groups got together and they said, what do we have to lose? We have everything to gain.
There's, like, one thing I really like about this kind of stuff is, like, there's, it feels like something is broken in America. We've lost sight of, like, why we work to a certain degree. Like, I mean, there's a Sean Fain quote in, like, your interview with him where he talked about how his parents, his grandparents had to leave Tennessee. I guess they were from Tennessee to go to Detroit to get jobs for Chrysler and General Motors. And those jobs changed their lives because there just wasn't work in Tennessee. And he's like, why weren't there jobs like that here? And it's like, they had to move away from friends and family, which is the, you know, your community, the people you spend time with, the people you enjoy being around in a place you wanted to be, because the job there wouldn't support you. Now, I know that there's never going to be any perfect economic system that keeps the great jobs in every specific location. But in general, like, there are automotive jobs in Tennessee and they pay like shit right now, right? Until this factory opens. And, like, I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about quality of life stuff, which obviously nobody votes just their pocketbook. And the anti-union forces know that, because one of the billboards has stuck with me. in the 2014 anti-auto workers drive at this Chattanooga plant. One of the billboards was, the UAW wants your guns.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, so you recognize that people want dignity. They want dignity outside of work. You know that. And you're lying to them about what that is to give them a different kind of dignity. It's just like, do what I'm saying make sense? I feel like I lost a mind maze or something.
No, it makes perfect sense, right? And it's what we are all familiar with. You know, these rich and powerful forces, they can never talk about economics. They can never talk about that because their ideas are horrible for that. Their ideas are, we get all the money, you do all the work, and we're going to get away with the lowest wage we can possibly pay you. Do you think that would work in a democracy? No, it's shit. Right? Nobody wants that.
It doesn't work in a capitalist economy either, because the cars go to shit because you're making them poorly. Then you leave town with a bag of money, the company goes under, and the factory's empty. And we're like, well, what happened to the fucking CEO? He's in St. Bart's. It's like, it's not a way to run an economy either, is the thing about it.
No, it's not a way to run an economy. But, so, you know, they can't talk about that, so they do these crazy things and talk about guns. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I feel like even on that, it's the boy who cried wolf thing. Right. How many times have we heard this? And I'll say this just to illustrate why I think the labor movement is so hopeful, so important at this moment, is what I keep seeing when I go out to cover these things, which is, you know, we're polarized. We have, you know, racial divisions. Right. Mm-hmm. But the labor movement is where a white Republican male, a black Democratic female, and everybody in between are forced to look at each other, see each other, understand each other, and stick together, or else they both sink. Mm-hmm. You know, that's and they're thrown together in this campaign for much more than money. This isn't just about money. This is about control and power over your own life in the place where you spend most of your day away from your family at work. Yeah. Right. So these people are thrown together. They rely on each other. And it's a way to get across those big racial divides. And I think we need it now, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, you watch some of these videos on videos of the people, the workers in at these plants in Chattanooga, like when the decision came down, oh, it worked, we got it. And it's like a rainbow coalition, man. It's all different types of people, white, black, every age, man, woman, whatever. And it's, you watch that and it's like, this is exactly the type of unity that like threatens the plutocracy so much. You know what I mean? Like, this is the same, like they want to, you know, turn poor people of all stripes against each other. It behooves them to do that. And they've been largely successful with it. And I think you're right. You watch big labor victories like this and you can see the potential in it for grander change in this country. And it's like, that got lost somewhere along the way. That was happening. It's like it was working, man. People were coming together and then it just got dropped. And
I mean, it's like
profit, I guess. I don't know. Like,
there's a lot, like John might know, like I only know of like a vague, I read a This Day in Labor History blog read by a labor historian, but like one of the reasons the South is under unionized is there's a lot of like racist strike breaking tactics people have historically used where it's like, oh, so you all want to be paid the same? You as a white worker want to be the same. It has been an effective strike breaking tactic. That's why it's cool when it doesn't fucking work. So there you go. That's all I want to say.
So what do you think about the like prognosticating a little bit here? We've alluded to it a couple of times already, but some people are saying, oh, this is the first very important domino to fall when it comes to labor in the South. Like, what's next in your mind? Mercedes in Alabama, right? That's the next big one that's coming up. Tell us about that. How you feel about it?
Yeah, let's get a little broader view here, too. I think it's important to remember just how intense this is, right? Mm-hmm. The leader of the UAW, Sean Fain, is a great person. If you don't know him, you should look him up. He has been elected for 14 months. And the leadership before Sean Fain, only 14 months ago, went to jail. Okay, unions like any other corporation, democracy, they're susceptible to human things like corruption. Okay, so the prior leadership, they were using member dues to, you know, buy boxes of cigars and whatnot. Then there was a reform campaign. This brought Sean Fain in, and a lot of people, and he brought democracy to the union, right? And that's why we're seeing a lot of these organizing drives, because his campaign turned power into members' hands. They started putting money, millions of dollars, behind new organizing, and that's why they're in the South, right? This is something that was not prioritized by previous leaders. So they went big on the big three. They won there. They went down to Volkswagen, said it couldn't be done. They won there. Mercedes, they have an interesting strategy here too. You know, they're not going everywhere all the time. They're prioritizing their resources in this stand-up strike is what they're calling it. They'll say, hey, Mercedes, Alabama, your turn to stand up. And then they focus right there. So I think anytime you see them going to a place, you can bet that there's been some good progress made on the ground and some money invested. I don't want to get into predictions or whatnot, but there's going to be setbacks. But Mercedes, you know, it's a company that is less friendly than Volkswagen. Alabama certainly isn't the most friendly territory for this. But I think nonetheless, it's going to be a real fight. And beyond that, Sean Fain himself said, you know, when we come back to the bargaining table, it's not just going to be the big three, it's going to be the big 12. He's going after Tesla, right? And this is one by one, battle after battle. We're going to see it happen. The last thing I want to close on here is May 1st, 2028. That is the date that Sean Fain said, we want to align all of the union contracts. We want to make an appeal to unions. Make your contracts expire May 1st, 2028. Everybody knows that people get on Twitter, they call for a general strike, never happens, and it's a little bit crazy. This is kind of the first time, though, that we might see a real unique labor strategy of aligning contracts so everybody goes on strike May 1st, 2028. So pay attention to that.
Do you need to go, John, or can I ask you another question or two?
No,
do you
please. Have a hard out?
Okay. Yeah. So I'm glad you brought up the corruption thing, because I saw an interview with a worker who was talking about how the three big reasons he had for supporting this union drive. One of them was like seeing the sitting president walk a picket line and stand behind you, the Labor Department stand behind unions. The second one was like he called out the Writers Guild strike, which I thought was interesting as inspirational, which is there's other more inspiring stories in the labor movement. Although thank you for the shout out as a card carrying member. But the third one was the corruption angle, where he just trusted the institution more. And I just thought that was super cool and important. Was it just cigars, or what else were they up to before the reform movement?
Oh, well, you know, $13,000 in one day on only cigars. That, you know, use your imagination. There was a lot of other shit going on there. But, you know, this was, it's really a new, the point to make there is that this is a new labor movement. There's still a lot of sentiment out there, especially people not familiar. Oh, you know, it's Jimmy Hoffa and the unions of the 70s, the mob and all of this. Look, every union's different, but by and large, we have, you know, new leadership in a lot of these unions. We have people unionizing like Starbucks and Trader Joe's. And don't forget, there's an Amazon labor union, okay? They only unionize one place, haven't negotiated a contract because it's Amazon, and they're, you know, doing a bunch of crazy shit to make sure that doesn't happen. But this is a new movement, and you have people like Sean Fain coming into one of the, you know, biggest, most powerful legacy unions and saying, we're going to go one member, one vote. So it's direct democracy. It is putting power in the hands of members. And you see how that resonates with people. And the other thing is, this is a testament to political courage, right? Guy's only been elected for 14 months. His election was close. The leaders before him were in jail. Nobody would have blamed him for not reaching for the stars here, but he said, we're going to take a big bet. People are ready for it. We've turned power to their hands, and it's paying off, you know? So I think political courage is something to say about it.
So Sean Fain said something I never heard before. He talked about the big three and the German three. I didn't realize German automakers made like 50% more money in profits than American automakers do, and they don't have to be have unionized factories in the United States. Is that right?
This over my head. I don't know.
Oh yeah, I do. But I just saw this quote. This is I'm quoting from Paul Blast, one of your coworkers at More Perfect Union.
Yeah, yeah.
A piece he wrote. He said, "Alabama has only been producing automobiles for less than 30 years, but the state is already the leading exporter of vehicles in the United States." The biggest export of cars in America is Alabama. I did not see that coming. And for Jeremy Kimbrell, a Mercedes-Benz worker involved in the UAW push, it's simple. Everybody knows where a Mercedes is. Why should a worker, just because he lives in Alabama, be paid less and be treated worse? That's old-timey fucking thinking, right? Yeah. And I just, like, the South, why is it always, Southern economy always based upon the promise of free and cheap labor, like going back to 1692? Right. You know?
Yeah. So, John, I wanted to ask, we're talking about leadership and all this and how it's like, oh, it's a new labor movement and things are going on. As a journalist in this field, I was wondering what you thought about how much does the Biden administration have to do with any of this? Like Mark was saying, it's like, this is a fuck it, we'll do it ourselves moment. Like, is that irrelevant? How much, if any of a part, have they played in what's happening here? Because it has been happening during, you know, Biden's tenure in the past couple of years. So what do you think? What's your perspective on that?
We'll go short answer first. And I say very little, but a very important part. Okay. So I want to say this. The administration that you have in there really does make a difference because they appoint people to run the National Labor Relations Board. This is the government agency that determines how powerful unions are. Biden's been very, very good on that front. He's also, and it's important, to have somebody who's doing a job like that. He's had labor fuck-ups, to be honest. I covered East Palestine. He lobbied against a rail strike. Beyond having a favorable National Labor Relations Board, which is very important, this is really in the hands. What we're seeing in this new labor movement is made by workers and workers themselves. It's not even Sean Fain. It's not the presidents of these unions. It is working people seeing a vehicle to exercise their power and realizing that that's a thing that they can do. I mean, we don't even think about that, you know, in America, right? We don't think about, hey, how can we exercise control over our workplace? We're just conditioned to do what the boss tells us.
Right.
We're in a global moment now where we're starting to really question that, and we're finding these old labor roots and kind of inhabiting these organizations that have been dead and gone for a long time with new life. And that's producing, you know, favorable leaders who actually listen to people. And the last thing here is I hope it affects the Democrats, because along with the death of unions, you know, Democrats used to answer to the organized working class. Okay. And then they started taking corporate money, and it was like, hey, we're just going to compete with Republicans for corporate money. And you never win with that. Okay. So we got NAFTA and Bill Clinton and all the rest, and Democrats kind of became complicit in screwing the working class. And what I hope for, and what I think is, you know, a real thing that we can all start hoping for, is that the organized working class becomes the base of the Democratic Party again. And we actually have an opposition party in this moment where fascism's rising that is worth a damn.
Hell yeah, brother. I love that. I think on that note, we can let John go, Mark. But John, I wanted to give you a chance. If you have any kind of like parting thoughts or any way people could support you or the movement generally, where you want to direct people, anything like that, please do so.
Number one, want to say thank you to More Perfect Union. I work for them, and especially my producer, Katie Nixdorf, on this story. They are really great. I work with a lot of them. Go follow Perfect Union. Shout out to the Tennessee Hauler. Love y'all, but I have my own newsletter, and I hilariously named it The Hauler. That is my newsletter, thehauler.co. Didn't know there were so many haulers out there. It's a great name, and every one of them is doing great work. So follow both of us if you want to do that. And the last thing, you can follow me on social media at Hey John Russell.
Right on.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Appreciate you, buddy.
Thank you, guys.
Fantastic, as always.
All right.
Thanks, brother. All right.
I do wanted to say, like, somebody because he brought up the mafia. Like, one of the reasons unions had the mafia is because the companies had the cops. And one thing the president and the governors can do that really helps, that doesn't seem like much, is to not send in the fucking National Guard. Because you know the phones are ringing. Yeah,
Mark, I know you don't see the private chat that we have back here that we can see, but producer,
I had it open now to see when John got here, so I saw you.
Producer Matt, just so y'all know, because I think you the audience will appreciate it. Producer Matt just texted us in the private chat thanking the producer. That's interesting. All right, Matt.
Well, we have plenty of time to thank you in between calling for the video and getting the video. So that's a good way to fill that time.
Yeah, there it is. Nice. Mark knocking it out of the park. Out of the park, Mark. Beverly Hayworth Hitkin says, great show. Thank you very much. That's mostly due to John. Me and Mark were flailing before he got here, in case you missed it. Le Dragon de Jardin says, came in late, but John rocks. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Yeah, go back and watch the rest of it. You can watch the rest of it, you know. Or anyway, Freya says, already signed up at More Perfect Union. Yeah, support them. Doing good work over there. And John Orbit Bainbridge says, much love, John, and love More Perfect Union.
Oh, I meant to, because John said, I'm not a real journalist. He just go out and talk to people. That's what a journalist is supposed to do, not sit in the studio and read spreadsheets. But you are out there doing it, John. But also I wanted to say, like, one of the things that's really cool about More Perfect Union, if you go follow their stuff, is they go out and talk to workers. You might have noticed there's a business section in the newspaper, but no labor section. So, like, if they go out and talk to, hey, are you making enough money? What could be better at your job? They're like, oh, here's what I'm saying. No one ever asked that. It's nice that someone's asking that. So, yeah.
Yeah. And that red wave of ketchup says, smash the like button, y'all. Thank you, Red Wave. Please do. Smash that like button, subscribe, share, tell your friends. Helps with the algorithm and engagement and all these internet words that I don't actually understand what they mean, but I've heard that it helps. So thank y'all for doing those things. Do the internet things. We appreciate it. But yeah, I was hoping we'd get to it, and you got to it right at the very end. The idea is, like he said, you know, his hope is that it can become like the working movement can become a foundational part of the future of the Democratic Party or whatever, because I've always, and we've talked about it plenty of times, long lamented the fact that that got lost, because that used to be the case. I mean, really, before I can even remember, that used to be the case. And then for my entire life, it's just been lost. And now, like, so many working people fucking hate Democrats, and it's a goddamn shame, because it ought not be that way, because Republicans fuck them over at every turn. So they need to figure it out, need to claw that back.
Yep. It'd make a big difference, especially in economic matters.
Spring Lizard says, thank you for such an informative show. Love to celebrate good news, right? I know. We don't get to do that very often around here. It is nice.
Something we didn't get to that I wanted to mention. This isn't just a victory for workers at that factory, because I brought this up before, but studies show that unions reduce wage inequality, improve workplace conditions, and increase the wages of both union and non-union workers. Because it makes the job environment more competitive in whatever town the union's in. And if you want to compete with this Volkswagen factory and you run a plant down the street, you better fucking come up off your those dollars, man. So it helps everybody. So that's it's not just a victory for people at that plant. It's a victory for the state of Tennessee and the people of Chattanooga. So, yeah.
And so many companies out there that have unionized in the past are still somehow, against all odds, managing to keep the lights on and stay operating. They did not get thrown up, put under, by having their employees unionize. Weirdly, they somehow rallied together, management did, and found a way to survive despite having unionized employees. Testament to their resolve, I suppose.
Not only that, they do better.
Right. Yeah.
Again, everyone in Germany.
Never have.
Yeah.
Right.
Because when people like going to work and feel valued, they do better jobs. It's crazy. Yeah.
We got Kraft Dinner here, who's been here before, because I remember me and Mark talked about, what is Kraft Dinner? That's how I know they're a Canadian. Says, missed the Vancouver show. Hope you enjoyed the visit. I did. Well, I mean, I was in and out, unfortunately. Came in, did the show, and had to leave to go to Seattle the next day. But Vancouver's a lovely city. I got up there, and I was freaking out, kind of, talking to my opener. And that's the second show I've done in Vancouver. And I've also done Calgary and Edmonton, but not in like 5 years. And I was telling the host before we went on, who's a Canadian guy, Abdul Aziz, very funny guy. Shout out to him, Canadian comic. I was like, dude, my shit is so American. It's like so much of it is not even like overtly political or whatever, but all of it is very culturally American, I feel like. So much about, you know, even the South. Like, what does Canada know about the American South or what that means or any of this shit? You know, I started thinking all that, and I was like, dang, we're fucking, you're not going to get whatever. And he was like, dude, we're aware. You know, he was like, you guys are the spectacle that we all can't turn away from. So we're very aware of what you have going on.
Vancouver's literally, you can throw a rock from America and hit it, right?
That's what he said too. He said also Vancouver is the most American Canadian city, so you'll be fine. And it was fine. It was fun.
And if you think Canadians don't have rednecks, watch Letterkenny.
No, I know that. I know that, man. For sure. Letterkenny, Trailer Park Boys. I recommend the YouTube video Out for a Rip. That's a good one. Anyway, yeah, they definitely got rednecks. Betty Veronica 2.0 says taking a friend for her birthday to see Trey's show. Well, that'd be fun. I don't know which city you're talking about, but it'd be a good time regardless. On that note, once again, I remind you, go to TreyCrowder.com and check out my upcoming tour dates. I've had a little bit of time off other than those the shows we just mentioned, but starting in mid-May, I'm back on the road and back on it heavy for pretty much the rest of the year. That graphic will be updated in the near future. We've got stuff going all the way through 2025 already and still adding more. So I'm going everywhere. Come to TreyCrowder.com and check out the dates and come and see me. Also on the website, you can find a link to me and Corey's book, which is still on sale at Audible. The audiobook is on sale for the rest of the month of April. So check that out. And lastly, support the show and get more of it by signing up on Patreon, weeklyskews.com/more, or just go on Patreon and search for my name. $5 a month, full-length bonus episodes. We're doing another one this week. It's going to be fun. Most importantly, y'all keep watching us on Skewsdies, and we'll keep doing it. We'll see you in 7 days. Love you. Bye.